Dr. Dietz?
Well, thank you. You guys did a great job. You posed 70 questions by the time this panel had finished speaking, and unfortunately, we can't address every one of those questions. So the group in the back, that highly intellectual and savvy group, culled from your questions some of the more pertinent ones that they thought this panel could address. So the first question is, can you give examples of how you dealt with a nutrition intervention program that wasn't well received in your culture, the culture in which you were working? And how does one compromise or negotiate the intervention to satisfy both the culture and the nutritional needs of the population? And I'd like each of the panelists to answer that in one or two sentences.
Yes, I have dealt with resistance in both Paraguay and Mexico to a nutrition intervention. And it all comes down to figuring out how you can communicate to someone that something is relevant to them, how they have to do it, what it is, and what's the cheapest way that they can make it happen. And you can change that.
Great. Rebecca.
In Cambodia, they don't eat a lot of peanuts, so the peanut paste is very unacceptable. So they found they're trying to make a fish flavored. So just very simple. Think what appeals to the culture and change your recipe. So.
Noah.
Probably the biggest problem that we had was having this organization that was the bunch of outsiders coming into the slum and telling people what to do. And that was very difficult to overcome. And the only way that we could overcome it was by showing results. And we had a huge amount of people being, there were a lot of people that were upset with what we were doing. But as soon as we could start showing that as a result of the information, the services that we were providing, kids were healthier and they were staying alive.
Great. Daniel?
Yes, diabetes is stigmatized in certain social networks in the Middle East. And so what we did was basically leverage existing customs, which is just basically the family and social group, to overcome these barriers.
Great. I would just add one point that was inherent in what all of you said, and that is the importance of listening. That's the way you understand a culture, not coming into it with a preconceived notion of what they need, but listening to what they need. Rebecca, should we hold companies that sell or produce high-fat, high-sugar foods accountable? Should we have higher taxes that require invest in community programs like recreational activities or so forth?
I'm supposed to keep this short, but I just want to be a dork about nutrition. I loved your questions. I thought they were great. So we only have time to answer a few. But in regards to this question, I think the real important thing when you're talking about taxing junk food is who are you targeting with that tax? If poor people are the people that are the largest consumers of junk food, you're actually taxing the poor. It's not the correct redistribution of wealth, in my opinion. But Norway, for example, actually has a tax on sugar foods, on sweets, and they do it successfully. So I think that it's very contextual. You have to understand the community that you're working in. Would it work in the United States? The people that are consuming the junk food in the United States are the poorest people. So I think it really is contextual to understand who's consuming that food and who is that tax directed at.
Great. Thank you. Noah, do you think that the problem of malnutrition, which is a part of the broader problem of maternal and child care, occurs because of the focus of funding organizations on vertical programs that target only certain diseases rather than building up primary health care and maternal and child health care?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
This is one of the most challenging things that I, as the director of an organization doing maternal and child health and nutrition work, I deal with every day. Maternal and child health is not sexy. It's very difficult to get money for it. You don't see the, when you talk about child deaths, yes, 50% are associated with malnutrition, but that may not be the ultimate reason that they're dying. They may be dying of diarrhea, which is associated with undernourishment. it is trying to get funding for this is very difficult. And I think there needs to be a way that we can make it clear that maternal and child health is really at the core of so much of development work, so much of nutrition and health work. And the fact that 30% of children in India are born with low birth weight, which is the number one predictor of whether or not a child is going to be malnourished later on in life or whether or not that child is going to survive. 30% of children in India are born low birth weight, which means under 2.5 kilograms. And it's absolutely unacceptable. And yet it doesn't seem like it's a human right to ensure that mothers and kids have the proper health services. And I think we need to figure out a way to make it a little bit sexier. I'm not exactly sure how to do that. And I think that's probably a great challenge for all of you.
So help Noah. Gabriela, how did you bring a commercial partner on board to produce Amaranth, and what is their commercial model, and can it be replicated?
Well, first of all, I'd like to explain a little bit about the market value of Amaranth in Mexico right now. Currently, our producers are getting about 14 pesos per kilo that they produce, as opposed to 2.5 pesos that they get for producing corn, which is what most of them are producing. So on the other side, there is a booming market right now for amaranth in Mexico and eventually in the United States. Well, we believe that is going to happen. So currently there is, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Ashoka, but there is a Oaxacan Ashoka scholar in Oaxaca who started an amaranth factory and is one of our main collaborators. And they are giving a fair price to farmers who are producing both organic and non-organic amaranth. That was not a difficult collaboration because this is a non-profit organization, so it's two non-profits joining together to make our projects more sustainable so that they'll last longer. We also have a for-profit collaborator in one of the poorest regions of Oaxaca, actually, ironically. He is giving his producers a much lower price, still a very competitive price with amaranth, with corn. He's giving them about 9 pesos, and he is also producing it much cheaper and looking for ways to fortify his amaranth and put it in a way so that people can mix it with the cornmeal for their tortillas so that it's actually consumed automatically every day. In rural Mexico, the tortilla is the spoon. People eat everything with a tortilla. And finally, on a bigger level, we collaborate with a woman in Querétaro, which is a much wealthier state in Mexico, and she has actually dedicated years and years and years to get amaranth into Kellogg's. So we're working with a really good market, and so we have that on our side.
Thank you. Daniel, how do we make policymakers understand the issues in developing countries when they've never been there and have no firsthand experience of undernutrition or malnutrition?
Well, I think that's a very important question, because while you can make change from the bottom up, ultimately you also have to make change from the top down. And so I'm a guy who sort of likes statistics, and so I'll just throw one out to begin with. Three lifestyle changes, exercise, diet, and smoking cessation, can prevent 4 chronic diseases, cancer, hypertension, diabetes, and obesity, which amount to about 50% of deaths each year in the world. So if you look at that statistic, you notice that three of the chronic diseases relate to what we're talking about here today. And what this translates to for a public policymaker would be this is going to cost governments a tremendous amount of money. In a place like Jordan, chronic diseases and obesity will undo the economic advances and undermine their economies. what this means for a public policymaker in the United States could be you have a lot of people who are going to be poor, poverty alleviation will go up, and in a conflict ridden area like the Middle East, then you know, you definitely want to try to create as much stability as possible. So I think just making the point that this is a huge problem, it's only increasing, and it's going to really have an impact on economies around the world would be the way to go.
Great. Thank you. Now we're coming to some of the themes that you all have posed, that the folks in the back have collated.
Wow. You guys came up with some amazing ideas. We quickly tried to boil them down into main themes, and then we took a couple individual ideas as well that we thought were particularly compelling and applicable. First of all, we have the idea of students and campuses putting pressure on companies, holding them accountable for what they're selling, and holding them accountable for promoting healthy lifestyles, not only marketing their own individual products. Taking it to a governmental level, demanding government bodies to reform trade rules to encourage local sustainable food practices. Volunteering as individuals, getting out, reaching out, and working with organizations that work directly on these issues that may already be in place in your community. Using college resources to innovate genetically modified and fortified foods. Many of your universities have top-notch science departments, top-notch faculty, PhD and graduate students, maybe creating a competition where they could work together on these issues. Next, we have tapping into local and pop culture to change behavior in at-risk communities. A little bit on what Gabriella was talking about that Puente is doing in their community. Educating future business leaders on the problem of malnutrition. So maybe we're talking about curriculum changes here in business school or people headed in that track. Students can partner with professors to raise awareness, and educating campus communities about the truth of malnutrition through awareness events. So just general campaigns on campus to promote awareness about these issues and potentially thinking about promoting awareness of how easy it really is to solve these problems, that 10 cents can buy a meal for a child at their school. Next, we have the GEMS. Donate leftover meal points to United Way. How many of you at the end of a semester or a term have leftover points on your card? Maybe you let them go to waste, maybe you stock up on Tide detergent for next semester, whatever you do with it, right? What if you could create a program where the university agrees to donate perhaps a dollar a point to United Way? Donating leftover food from university food service to local food banks. We've all seen the massive amount of waste that goes on. What if you could create a direct link that the local food bank come by once a week, twice a week, pick up the leftovers. Maybe they're out of date for whatever reason the dining hall can't use them. Create curriculum that addresses the issues of global health with a local service component. What about a class that instead of holding class on Fridays, that hour and a half, that 2 hours, is you out directly on the ground with the community? Or working somehow on the internet with a communication project or a web design project dedicated to these issues. Organizing community garden for healthy food sources. Lastly, in the dining hall, chart how much food is wasted and how much an average food plate weighs. So again, awareness, making people aware. Now we have the wonderful opportunity for the panel to reflect on your ideas. I'll pass it back to them.
Great. Nice job. These are all very relevant and innovative and interesting questions. The first question that I think the entire panel is interested in responding to is this theme of volunteering or working for NGOs that address malnutrition. So what would you suggest that these students do in order to develop those linkages? Let's go this direction. Daniel.
Well, I suppose, first of all, I can speak for my own organization. We established global microclinic fellowships at UC Berkeley and also University of California, San Francisco, to enable students like yourselves to go for a summer or 6 months or a year to one of our projects and work and bring those fresh ideas, to take existing ideas in the field, to learn from the culture, but to bring your own and to try them there. And so beyond that, I mean, there are many other opportunities on college campuses, and I think that this is a very important part of education, this sort of experiential learning. And most professors, in fact, if you just approach them, will allow you to get some sort of academic credit as an independent study course or as part of your senior thesis that you may be writing. So just really to take advantage of these opportunities, because they will not only allow you to bring your own ideas, but they will also expand your own world and your understanding of these global problems.
Great. Let me just also ask the panelists if there's room for a student in this room to volunteer with your organization. Yes. Okay, Noah?
We have a policy at our organization that we have volunteers that come only if they're willing to commit to 6 months. And the reason for that is that we have a whole operation, and it takes there's a sort of amount of disruption that comes in. There's a lot of help that can come from volunteers, but there's also some disruption when you're talking about an organization that's as small as ours. But if any of you are interested in doing 6 months or more, definitely get in touch with me. I think there's really something to be said for this concept of small is beautiful, and I think that volunteering and working for NGOs is a terrific idea, and I think that one of the best things that we can do is we can learn from other people. We don't need to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot that we can do to learn from other organizations, and then we can think about being involved in starting our own organizations. I think that there's room in the world for people to start organizations, and one of the big problems in this field is that NGOs are, because they're competing for funds, they're not working together in the way that they should be. And I think that we can come together and we can change that. And I think that there's a lot of good models out there. So when you do go and look at organizations, when you do volunteer, think in the back of your mind about how you could take the model of that organization or take the model of another organization and bring it to a part of the world that you're particularly interested in that really is underserved.
Rebecca?
The Clinton Foundation does take volunteers and interns. I think in terms of working and volunteering with an organization, it's important to have a passion. Malnutrition is huge. It's got so many different facets and components that if you can whittle it down to the one thing, whatever it is that you're passionate about, you can make it happen. And I also think that those new ideas are really important. Just to give you a little example, in Nepal, they have a huge vitamin A deficiency, and they were able to, this doctor was able to isolate these small rural communities by working with grandmothers. The grandmothers didn't have anything to do. He gave them the vitamin A tablets, and that's how they helped address vitamin A deficiencies in those communities. So you can keep your ideas small, and they can have a huge impact.
Gabriela?
If you go to the Puente website, puentemexico.org, you can find, .org, Spanglish coming out. Anyway, we have a lot of volunteer opportunities, and our volunteers are precious and very valuable to us. If I could be so bold as to just give some advice as far as this goes, find an organization that will give you the opportunity to really work. Volunteers, it is such a broad category. If you hear somebody say they have a clearly defined internship for you, or, you know, look for those characteristics, because you want to learn as well as give ideas, and you want to get out there and learn things from that organization. And also take advantage of a volunteer opportunity that will let you get in the field. Any kind of work that you want to do in nutrition is completely different if you've been in the field and if you have seen malnutrition, not just for emotional reasons and, I've seen it and, it's really affected me, but because you understand what it looks like. It's not just the skinny, hungry child that you see on World Vision and the television. And So I really encourage everybody to take advantage of those volunteer opportunities.
Great. Rebecca, how should we pressure companies to promote healthy foods and lifestyles?
I think that you can go at it from two angles. There's the advocacy angle, sort of the negative angle, like if you look at what Morgan Spurlock did with the film, and now I'm blanking on it. Sorry? Thank you. That actually caused the introduction of salads to McDonald's, so it makes an impact. I think you can also look at it from the other angle. What are you bringing to a company? Why would they want to invest or make a change in their products? Danone is now looking at fortifying yogurts. Why did they do it? It's because they saw a market. So I think if you look at either, you can go from the advocacy angle or you can go at it from really a market perspective. How is this company going to profit from what I'm proposing?
Gabriella, how should we be educating campus communities about the truths of malnutrition through awareness events?
Well, I think, that's worded a little differently. I think it's really important to get that awareness at a college level. I was not aware of these things that were happening, and it wasn't that long ago that I was in college. So what is appealing to you, and what would be appealing to your classmates? How could you really get people to care and be interested in this cause? I would just encourage you to collaborate with friends you have that are working in media and that are working in marketing and ways to actually get people interested in something and combine those interests. It doesn't have to be the development globally minded people are over here and the marketing business minded people are over here and those things can't mix. Really, we're all resources in this fight against malnutrition.
Thanks. We have just a very short time left. Noah and Daniel, anything to add to these themes that you think is particularly pertinent?
I think that really the most important thing, as it's been said before, is just really to focus on one of these issues and to narrow it down to a sizable chunk. To get some experience, educate yourselves about the issue at hand, and then just come up with some small way to begin with that you can really make a difference. And in doing so, you'll make a dent and bring global solutions to bear.
Great. Thank you. Noah?
I think that it's really one of the things that we can do is we can come together and really think about the fact that just within this time that we've been sitting here in the luxury of this place talking about this important issue, 1,250 children have died. And that is, to me, something that brings home the reality of why it's so important that we do this work. Just keeping in mind that, there are a lot of people in the world that are doing this kind of work and that are making a difference and there are models out there and that we don't need to be heroes. We don't need to invent some new technology. There are technologies out there. There are models out there. And we can be saving lives by using a huge amount of research that's been done in the past. And it's to our advantage to use what's already out there.
Rebecca, a closing comment? Or Gabriella? I hate to put you on the spot.
I guess I really like what everyone has been saying today about listen. How can you make it appropriate, whatever intervention you choose, whatever you choose to do, to the community that you're planning on doing that? That's really, I think, the only way you're actually going to get long-term lasting impacts is listening to the people whose lives you will be affecting.
Gabriella?
Well, I just want to thank you all for being interested in this and being here. It is so exciting and inspiring to see everybody working and collaborating to do this. And well, I don't see it every day in Oaxaca, so it's nice to come here and see this huge effort. So thank you for coming.
Well, let me acknowledge the four of you because the work you're doing is terrific, innovative, and inspiring. So thanks very much for being part of it. And I should mention that we've just scratched the surface of this issue in 90 minutes. There's enormous complexity, as I think you've heard, to what each of these individuals is doing, and an enormous complexity to the overlay of social, cultural, governmental factors. But people can make a difference. And in every complex system, there are nodes that, if you are able to find those nodes and change them, you can change the world. And that's what this group is trying to do. That's what you're trying to do, and I would just encourage you to keep after it. So on behalf of the organizers, thank you very much for your participation. Thank you as well.
Before we turn to acknowledging the commitments, can I have just one final round of applause for the entire panel? And to all of you, thank you. Amazing. All right, I'm going to turn it back over to Dr. Dietz to acknowledge three commitments in particular.
Thank you. And Frankie, thank you for your organizational skills on this. You've done a great job. There are three individuals in the room who have made very substantial commitments to addressing this issue that we've been talking about. The first is Michael McHarg, and if he could come forward, Michael. Michael is from Duke University and who's partnered with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill to develop an online forum to allow key nutrition and ready-to-use therapeutic foods to be developed and applied. Ready-to-use food stakeholders share best practices, disseminate market, commodity, and funding data, and debate current challenges and policy. These foods can play, as you've heard, a major role in preventing undernutrition. The group has held a preliminary meeting in September in 2007 where UNICEF expressed particular interest in this program. But in order to engage Duke students from a lot of different disciplinary backgrounds, they've developed an undergraduate course on using technology to address undernutrition, as well as creating summer service opportunities for undergraduates. They have also developed a ready-to-use therapeutic food-targeted global consulting practicum for the spring of 2009 for MBA students at Duke's Fuqua School of Business to contribute to the resolution of various segments of this value chain. Congratulations, it's a great program. I think we need to thank you. Our next commitment is from Yun-Jun Hao from Swarthmore. Yun-Jun has been working with Pomone Health to implement simple, cost-effective, and culturally sensitive programs to improve the general health of Pomone villagers in the Venezuelan Amazon. From 2000 to 2010, this student-led organization will implement an incentive-based waste management program to create a healthier place for the 3,000 Pomone villagers to live. By rewarding these villagers with bed nets for their participation in the cleanup effort, the program will decrease the rates of bacterial infection resulting from contact with waste and at the same time addressing malaria. This group will also work with local leaders to train villagers to use better composting practices to improve that will be used on the fields to improve crop yields. And in the future, the food obtained from these improved agricultural practices can be substituted for donated goods used to provide incentives for waste collection. 8 Swarthmore students have committed to spending this summer in Uriman to implement these programs and provide full-time assistance at the local medical clinic. The founders of this group, you included, I assume, will be moving to Pomone after graduation to work on these projects. Congratulations. The final commitment is by Alan Sessoms, who's the president of Delaware State University. Um, Delaware State University, the College of Public Health and College of Health and Public Policy, Makerere University Institute for Public Health, and the Ministry of Health in Uganda, and the Pan American Health Organization are partners in this effort to reduce malaria in Uganda by documenting policy changes in the malaria drug treatment regimen and sharing lessons learned with partners at the Pan American Health Organization for application to Latin America. This is an important part of Delaware State's international work that focuses on creating study abroad, service learning, and international development in locations dealing with significant global challenges. Delaware State's College of Health and Public Policy and their partners are committing to help reduce malaria in Uganda by understanding how policy changes affect health behavior at the individual and community level. In particular, this commitment will document the policy changes in the malaria drug treatment regimen, which targets 36% of Uganda's 10 million individuals population. Delaware State will share the lessons learned in planning and implementing this commitment with PAHO, which is working to address the malaria burden in Central and Latin America. Congratulations, Alan.
And that concludes working session number one. One final round of applause for everyone, all of you and the panel.
And ladies and gentlemen, as our program manager, Frankie Bevins, has mentioned, this does conclude our working session. Your meetups will begin in 15.